Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Our election 2018 coverage continues today. Up front, I sat down with Laura Ellsworth, one of three Republicans running for governor of Pennsylvania. Laura Ellsworth, welcome to Smart Talk.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I live in Pittsburgh. I'm a lawyer for almost 40 years, and my dad's family comes from five generations of people from Kingston, Pennsylvania, the eastern part of the state. Grew up in New York City, went to Princeton University undergrad, and moved to Pittsburgh in 1980 to go to law school, and fell in love with Western Pennsylvania and stayed.
What about your political past? What kind of experience do you have in elected office or politics?
The experience I have is in civic life and solving problems like taxes, infrastructure, pensions, and those kinds of things. And so I, in addition to being a litigator, ran the Pittsburgh office of one of the largest law firms in the world. And as one of the leaders of the largest businesses in Western Pennsylvania, I was invited to join in the process whereby Western Pennsylvania transformed itself from dead in the water in 1980 when I moved there to one of the most livable places in America. And how that happened was by galvanizing the private sector to do a lot of the planning and the number crunching and the visionary work, and then partnering with the public sector to get things done. And over the last 15 years, I ran just about every one of the major economic development organizations that operates in Western Pennsylvania. So everything from business attraction, retention, economic climate, pension reform, tax reform, infrastructure, education spending, redesigning the workforce system to better align with the needs of employers. All of these different things were things that came within my responsibility, my leadership responsibility. And I saw the amazing work that men and women were doing shoulder to shoulder in the community to actually change things. And every time we went up to Harrisburg, legislators would say to us, oh, don't give us a choice between doing something and nothing, because we'll do nothing every time, because you can't get unelected for doing nothing. And they're right. And I saw fabulous people working in the communities getting things done, and I saw a professional legislature incentivized to do nothing so they could get reelected, and I thought, we need to fix this.
So you actually had legislators say, don't give us that choice because we'll do nothing.
All the time. Because they're right. Think about it. When people go and vote, they think, well, has this person done anything that made me mad? No, I'll go vote for them again. They don't look deeply enough sometimes. And the legislatures aren't bad people. They really are there to help do good things, but they also have this self-interest of running in the House every 2 years. And so I don't have that self-interest. I'm not a professional politician. I don't ever want to run for another office. I didn't want to run for this office. But what I wanted to do was get things done. And I know what we were able to get done in one corner of Pennsylvania where we transformed it. And I know, having worked statewide, that what we did there would work in every corner of Pennsylvania. And we need to get on with that. And knowing how that was done, helping lead getting that done, and knowing that the other people in the race didn't have that background, didn't have that experience or that knowledge, it needs to get done. And if I hadn't stepped out of my comfortable life to get in this race, I would have been ashamed of myself for the entire rest of my life.
Pittsburgh certainly has been a success story over the last decade or so. And most of the time, it's attributed to meds and eds, healthcare and educational institutions. So you said that you have been involved in that transformation. What kind of transformation can be made to bring Pennsylvania back, if that's the way to put it, to apply that success to the rest of Pennsylvania as you described it?
Eds and meds is accurate but too simplistic. It was also heavy manufacturing. It was professional services, banking, IT. We are, as you may know, Pennsylvania is the East Coast hub for all of the major IT, Uber and Apple and all Google, all of these things want to come here because we have fabulous students coming out of our universities trained in those skills. We have great quality of life. This is where they want to come and they want to be. So it's a really multifaceted solution that happened in Pittsburgh. And what we did is bring all of those different industries together, including our foundation community, right? And all these professional services, all of these manufacturers and the eds and the meds, bringing everybody around the table and figuring out what our vision and plan was for the future of our region, and then walking that out to implement those plans and benchmarking as we're going. Are we getting there or are we not? And right now in Pennsylvania, the two things that make my business successful and yours are what? A business plan and a budget. And this state has neither. Neither. And so we don't know where we're going. And the very first thing that we need is a 10-year business plan. And I am a visual thinker and I'm a demonstrative exhibit person. And so for me, I call it the map. It is a picture of what we want Pennsylvania to look like 10 years from now by our will and vision and purpose. Because if we don't know where we're going, we are never going to get there.
I want to go back to what you had said earlier about legislators who said that if they had a choice between doing nothing and doing something, they would choose nothing, and apply that to what you're talking about. You know, I doubt you have a vision of just a group of 10, 20, 30 people sitting around a table like maybe happened in Pittsburgh, but you do need cooperation. When you have that kind of attitude, how do you get the people who can make a difference, who can apply that plan, how do you get them at maybe that proverbial table? How do you get them to cooperate? Because let's face it, we are in a situation right now politically where there's a lot of partisanship. You may have the best idea in the world, but someone in the opposing party will say, not going to happen.
Right. So I'll tell you how we did it and how I did it in the projects that I led is if you come up with a really, really good idea, and you begin to get some momentum around that idea, often from the private sector, right? Bringing private sector leaders from across the state, get them together, get some momentum, have it be a really good idea. Politicians are dying to get on board that train to a good idea. And then they want to take credit for it. Awesome. Let them take credit for it. Give them cover if they need it. Because we're not about the credit. We're about getting the work done. And if we can come up with a really good idea, because these legislators, honestly, they are good men and women. They want to do something that's good, but they also want to be part of something that's success. And so if they see something that's going to be a success, and if they're working with somebody who they know and trust, honestly, only wants to get the thing done and doesn't care whether you're an R or a D or any of the above, just wants to get it done, they will come on board with you. And one of the other things I did, I call Prego spaghetti sauce. Remember Prego spaghetti sauce? Remember the old ads? It's in there, right? I would always do on every project, and I'd have Republicans and Democrats sitting around the table. I said, okay, here's our goal. This is where we're going. What do you guys need for you to get to yes? And sometimes they would say something that would fit in just fine. And I'd always draw the picture. I'd draw the schematic. I'd draw them in there. Okay, what do you need? What do you need? And we would get it in there. Because if people have something that they want for their own constituents, right, that they want to do or that they have a good idea, let's build it in as long as it heads to yes. And if it doesn't head to yes, I'd always go back and say, all right, try again. Well, what else could we do, right? How else can we get you to be a part of this project and still get to yes? And sometimes people will smile when you ask about working with me. They'll smile and they say, oh, she's so quaint. She actually believes in what she's doing, right? How quaint. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we had politicians who actually really wanted to get things done for people? I'm quaint. I'll own quaint all day long. And I think that's what we need more of, because I know the people that I have worked with across this state, they are brilliant. They are committed to their communities, legislators and private sector alike. What they are looking for is somebody who can lead them to a great idea, who can cause them to believe in one another, in ways that they deserve to be believed in. That's the kind of leadership we need. That's what we need to reinstate. And that's what works. That's what causes people to realize how greatness can happen. Because they'll be afraid of greatness if they don't really believe that it can happen.
This campaign in the Republican primary, your two opponents have gotten most of the attention because there has been an ongoing battle of negative commercials on television. You haven't gotten into that. Some would say that one of the reasons you haven't gotten into that is that you don't have as much money as they do. But let me just ask you, first of all, about that ongoing TV commercial war and your thoughts on it.
I think that every penny they invest in those ads is a penny in my column on the financial side, because I know voters do not want their politicians talking about each other. They want them talking about the voters and their lives and their issues. They don't want cartoons. there are real people that are really hurting in our state that need things done for them. And I think people are looking for civility and decency and honor to be restored to politics, and they're not seeing it. And I walk into rooms and there are people who say to me, I've seen the other two and I'm already voting for you before you ever open your mouth. So I don't open my mouth because it can't get any better than that. But I think it's we owe that to the voters. You know, one of the reasons I think we see such low voter turnout in so many races is because I think people, many people have thrown up their hands and they've said, why bother? Because all politicians are the same. It's always going to be the same. It's never going to change. It can change. It can change with somebody who is not a conventional politician, who is not self-interested in their next race, who has a track record of for decades contributing to a community for free when nobody was looking and actually making a transformative change in that community, with the ability and the conviction to deliver that same performance in every corner of this state. That candidate exists in this race. And when people look at what they're seeing on TV and they say, no, I don't want that, I think they will look at what their alternative is. And I think that what they will find is the person who they find who was there and the most qualified person all along is actually the person that can lead this state forward to be what I believe it has every opportunity to be. It's just sitting there right in front of us for the taking and what we deserve to be.
Even though voters may not like negative ads like that, we do have an adversarial election system. So you do have to talk about why you think you are a better candidate. I'll ask that question. Why do you think you're the best candidate to be the Republican nominee for governor?
I think there's two things. I think it's experience and leadership. So I think experience matters. I've described for you all the work that I've done for 15 years with demonstrable results in a very broad range of issues, pension, transportation, economic development, education, all these things we're talking about, I've actually worked in and delivered results in. If you look at the other candidates in the race, Mr. Mango lived 15 minutes away from me in Pittsburgh. He was also a corporate leader. I never saw him or heard of him until he announced for governor. He never lifted a finger to help on any one of these civic issues in a leadership role or otherwise from the day he moved to Pennsylvania. And I think that says something both about qualifications and about dedication to the mission. You know, somebody once said to me, some people go into politics because they want to do something, and some people go into politics because they want to be something. Right? I see in him somebody who didn't do anything till he wanted to be something. And I don't think we need any more of that. I think if you look at Scott Wagner, again, he has been involved in one business all his life. And I think he has a lot of what Wolf has, which is a management style that grows out of owning and running your own business. And when you own and run your own business and you say jump, people jump. And we know that's not how Harrisburg works. And I think if you look at Senator Wagner's record since he's been there, and you look at, you know, whether he has led any legislative efforts and whether that's been successful, the answer is no. And I think part of the reason is leadership style matters. We have seen in these ad wars the leadership style that we're going to get from these two gentlemen. I don't think that's what we need. I don't think that's what we want. And I don't think that's productive. I think that ability to lead and inspire really matters. And I think it is important to look not just at what people say, but how they act when the moment comes to act. And I think the ads, as negative as they are, I think are instructive on that important point.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We are speaking with Laura Ellsworth, who is Republican candidate for governor of Pennsylvania. The May 15th primary coming up, she faces two opponents, and the winner of that primary goes on to face incumbent Democrat Tom Wolf. You were talking about your opponents in the Republican primary. What about Governor Wolf? What don't you like about Governor Wolf? Why do you think that you could do a better job governing this state?
I like Governor Wolf. I think he's a perfectly nice man. We meet with him all the time on a lot of different issues. But I think if you look at what he's done and you look at where we are, I think that speaks for itself. We are at the bottom in Pennsylvania of every significant list of every important economic indicator of growth, education. You pick the issue that's important. We're at the bottom. The list that we're at the top of is, we made the top five on this one, worst run states in America. And this, people who are looking to invest and grow and come to Pennsylvania, this is what they're looking at. And so I think as decent a person as he is, he has not performed. I think the idea that you would not sign a budget in 3 years of having been up there is the most irresponsible thing. If I hadn't signed a budget for my organization, year one, I would have been gone. By year three, impossible. And so I think that level of performance, that level of disengagement and inability to lead toward a plan is something that we all are suffering from. I think what I described for you before, the kind of performance that we have demonstrated in Western Pennsylvania of knowing how to engage people better. I go all across the state, all sorts of manufacturing facilities, for example, who say, the governor's never been here. I've never seen him. He never asked what it took to grow my business or help me do better. He just hasn't been there and he hasn't done it. He hasn't been out in Silicon Valley selling Pennsylvania for all the amazing assets that it has and why everybody should come here and be here. He hasn't been any of the places. We do a lot of work in public-private partnerships across the country. And there's billions of dollars of assets that are flowing into these across the country. They're not coming into Pennsylvania because in that business, they call Pennsylvania the place where P3s go to die. Because this governor's never been able to get one done. They did it in the bridge, you know, reconstruction locally, poorly, and they've never been able to do it and to generate the benefits that other states are seeing. So it's just a complete non-performance, and we need to correct that with people who understand how to change that.
So what would you do? I mean, you've talked about going to Silicon Valley, but what else? As governor, what would a Governor Ellsworth do to bring business to Pennsylvania?
The first two things I would do is to deliver what we all have for our businesses, a business plan and a budget. And Pennsylvania has neither. So I would bring together the leaders, legislative and private sector from across the state. I think I already know who they are. Bring them together and develop a 10-year business plan for Pennsylvania, what it looks like, where we're going. And then every budget decision we make is dependent on, does this budget decision advance or retard the achievement of that 10-year plan? And then I would look at how to redo our regulatory system. So one of the things that I have proposed, and you can see it on our website, is a responsible officer system where there is a real person with a real face and a real phone number who is responsible for delivering the regulatory decision in the reasonable time and the reasonable way that is ideally agreed to upfront. And if that person doesn't do it, there is another person that you can talk to make sure it gets done. And so the idea of a regulatory system that is an adversary to the citizens that it is supposed to be serving, government's a customer service organization. We're supposed to be serving them. And yes, there are regulations that need to be enforced, but they need to be enforced in a way where we remember that what we're trying to do is help people grow and develop their lives. And I think that those kinds of changes, changing the way we go about doing those things, those are some of the first things that I would do.
When you talk about not having a budget and a budget done on time, there's a reason for that in that the opposing party doesn't agree with the governor, and it's one of the reasons that we've had late budgets. So I guess I have a few questions as to how you work with the legislature, but let me ask it this way. When a Governor Ellsworth would propose a budget, what would be the spending priorities?
The spending priorities would be the same priorities of the 10-year plan. They are jobs and economic development. They are education and workforce, which in my mind are linked. It is resolving the educational crisis and fixing our 100-year-old transportation and infrastructure, which is holding back the creation of development. The other thing I would do and that I would work on is the transparency of government. Right now, there is so much robbing Peter to pay Paul. There is all the shell game that goes on up in Harrisburg. And it's one of the most difficult things when we go up to advocate on behalf of economic development and behalf of Western Pennsylvania to understand where all that money is moving in the sort of shadow budgets. We had to learn that. We had to understand it. It ought not happen. And it ought not happen in a way that is invisible to the citizens. And one of the things that I've done in my career as a litigator is you take complicated things, you distill them down, and you make them understandable to 6 or 12 ordinary citizens. And I believe what Lincoln said. I believe that if you take the facts to the people, they will get it right every time. And I have been in so many meetings up in Harrisburg where people will say to me around the table, oh, people won't understand this. This is too hard. The little people won't understand this. I'm like, time out. I'm the little people too. And I think I understand it better than you do. And so that thinking, there's a level of, exclusivity or arrogance that is just not warranted. And we need to understand that the people of Pennsylvania can understand these issues, the most complex issues, if we are forthright with them and honest and aren't playing these secret little games in the back rooms of Harrisburg anymore.
Even though you say you want your budget to be consistent with your 10-year plan, you have to have some priorities, some issues that you look at and say, okay, this is something where money must be spent. Obviously, there are mandates. There are things that billions of dollars that the state must spend money on. Mm-hmm. But is there something right now that you can look at and point to and tell voters that here's an area where my priority will be, and it will be reflected in my budget?
I think there are two that I would really focus on right early on. One is education, and the other is the opioid crisis, because I think relatively direct changes to those systems would materially improve our performance as a state. Now, I do not say more money for education, because I think we have conflated throwing money at a problem with solving the problem. But I would focus from day one on education, but I would ask a different question. Not how much money are we putting into education, but how are we changing the experience and qualifications of the children who are coming out of our educational system? And all the decisions we make about investment, incentives, and rewards, all of those things ought to be driven by the outcomes of our children, not the sheer dollars in. Because we know that some of the highest, most expensive districts have the lowest performing children. There are some reasons for that. But we need to completely whiteboard education funding and do it in a way that is fair and provides a diversity of learning, because all children learn differently. Anybody who has more than one child knows that all children learn differently. And so if our goal is to provide good learning for every child, to meet our children where we find them, we must provide the diversity of learning environments that allow them to find a place where they will learn best.
Pennsylvania, traditionally, and it's been pointed to through research, has a lot of inequity in our education funding. And I think that's kind of what you're referring to. But it has been that way for a long, long time. How do you change it?
The same way we've changed it before, is that you understand the facts first. One of the things I've learned in the 15 years of doing this work is that you go into meetings and you hear people restating the problem over and over and over again. And oddly enough, if you go into a dark room with a green eye shade on, roll up your sleeves, read the documents, do the math, the answer is really obvious. And when you bring those facts back to the table, everybody gets around the same problem. So the first thing I would do is I would understand exactly what the funding issue is across Pennsylvania. And right now it is so obscured by things like completely unfunded mandates that came down from Harrisburg, all sorts of education pockets of funding that don't work and are not transparent. So the first thing we need to do is understand where we are. We also then need to say our outcome metric, student success, is what we're going to be measuring and what we're going to be funding. And then we're going to look at what is a fair and equitable way to fund that system to achieve the best results for our children.
Property taxes is an issue that is related to education funding. There has been a move in Pennsylvania for the last three decades to try to reform property taxes. For the first time in probably those 30 years, in the last 4 or 5 years, there's actually been proposals to eliminate property taxes and go to other forms of taxation for school districts. What are your thoughts on eliminating property taxes, or I guess, again, how local school districts are funded?
I think it is unwise to completely eliminate property taxes, although I think they need to come down for a variety of reasons that I'll describe for you. The reason I don't agree with my opponents in this race, who would replace property taxes with other kinds of taxes, and you phrased the question exactly right. I think the issue is being framed so people think their property taxes will just go away. What's really being proposed by my opponents is that other taxes be substituted for them, right?
It has to be. Right.
So it's good that your listeners understand that. But I think property taxes have to remain a part of the equation for two reasons. Number one, because if you have market-based taxes, income taxes or sales taxes is the alternatives that are being proposed. When you have a market crash, as we did in 2008, those taxes are going to go down because people aren't going to be earning and they're not going to be spending. You can't have your educational system crash at the same time. You have to retain some level of stability and consistency and predictability, and sometimes ever more during those periods of downturn because you have to train people to come back into maybe what is a different economic world. So I think that's important. The other thing that I think is important is that if you transfer property taxes into pure market-based taxes, Harrisburg is going to sweep up all of the responsibility for the decisions that are made at the local level. And if local education departments want to retain their local control over their local education, you have to retain some part of the property tax equation as part of what you do, or you're going to lose control.
So you would oppose a higher percentage of funding coming from Harrisburg?
It depends on where you're talking about, right? So I think some property taxes need to be a part of this. But as you know, the property tax increase that's being experienced is the pension issue. And the pension issue is one that we need to bring down. And there are two things that I've proposed specifically to bring down the pension liabilities and therefore your property taxes. Number one, I would sell the state store system and I would apply the proceeds of that sale to the pensions to pay down the pensions. That solves three problems at once. Number one, it helps shore up the pension. It puts the state store system in the hands of private people, which will give you better price competition and service. And the third thing it does is it brings your property taxes down. We ought to solve multiple problems at once by solutions like that. And part of the reason that hasn't happened is because we haven't had sufficiently strong leadership at the top in Harrisburg that can counteract the individual incentives that individual legislators have to continue the system exactly as it is. We need that strong voice at the governor's level that can explain the value proposition to the people of Pennsylvania and they understand where it's coming from. The other thing I would do to bring down the pension liability and property taxes is I would go to the pension funds. And we know they're underfunded, but they have $73 billion in assets. And I would go to them and say, if you will invest those assets and if I can give you a better rate of return than the 1.3% that you're currently getting, which I can, will you invest in the creation of this, let's say, a pad-ready site that we need to attract this new business that wants to come to Pennsylvania, that we're competing with Ohio to score this business and bring these jobs and these tax revenues? If you invest that money, I'll give you the rate of return. I will also give you the taxes that come from this new business and all the jobs it creates to pick your number, a certain number for a certain time period, and so we'll pay down the pension liability. So that way you use the pension funds to solve their underfunding problem, to give them a good rate of return, and to create business and jobs and grow the tax base laterally. Those kinds of multifaceted solutions are what are demanded of us in the private sector all the time. We need to bring that kind of thinking, solving multiple problems at once in creative ways, not simply, do we tax or do we cut? Do we tax or do we cut? That's not good enough for Pennsylvania.
Let me ask you this, and kind of, if I could, ask for a quick answer. There have been a lot of Republicans over the last 10 years or so that have vowed not to raise taxes. Would you?
I think no tax pledges have gotten all sorts of people in trouble because they're not enforceable. And I think when you get up there and you find out what's really going on, your job is to be absolutely candid and forthright with people. What I will say is that I believe our taxes are too high. I believe that there are many solutions that can and should be implemented to bring them down. And I think it is the responsibility of a leader to bring down and reduce taxes every single place we can. But I think it is irresponsible for any leader to make a tax pledge in year one without knowing what the world is going to bring us over the term of that leader.
Laura Ellsworth is Republican candidate running for governor of Pennsylvania, and we hope to have her opponents on the program as well before the May 15th primary. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. In our second segment today, we're joined by Stephen Bloom, a current state legislator who is running for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 13th Congressional District. The 13th District includes Adams, Franklin, and Western Cumberland County in the WITF listening area. Representative Bloom, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. It's great to be back with you.
As I mentioned, you've been in the legislature, it will be 8 years by the end of this term, so many people in your district right now, your state district, are familiar with you, but the congressional district is much bigger, and I mean much bigger geographically. So for those people who don't know you, how would you introduce yourself?
Well, first and foremost, I'm married to my wife, Sharon. We've been married for 33 years. We've got three grown children, and my oldest child, our son, is married, and he's got three little boys and another one on the way. So my wife and I are grandparents of three and soon to be four little guys, and that's probably, you know, in terms of life accomplishments, that's certainly the thing I'm most proud of. And I have served in the state legislature since 2010. I never intended to be a politician. In 2008, 2009, I was so, as a conservative, I was just so personally frustrated with the direction that President Obama was trying to take the country and his agenda, that I felt I had to do something to combat that, to stand against that direction that he was taking the country. And so I ended up running for state house. I entered a 7-way Republican primary, somewhat similar to the 8-way congressional primary I'm now in on the Republican side. I ended up through a lot of hard work and great volunteers winning that race and then going on to beat the Democrat in the fall. So I've been serving as a state rep since 2010. And back then I ran on the agenda of cutting the size and scope of government, reducing taxes and unnecessary regulations, defending our constitutional liberties, including our Second Amendment rights and the rights of innocent unborn children to life. And by doing those three things, I know that that's how we can unleash the power of the American free enterprise system to lift people permanently from poverty to prosperity. And that's what I've tried to do for the last 7.5 years as a state rep. I believe I've been successful at that. I've been in the forefront of getting some really important bills passed to end the death tax on family farms, to end the death tax on small businesses, to reform the welfare system so that people don't have an incentive to stay on public assistance when they have an opportunity to get a job that might cost them some of those benefits. And so we've smoothed the benefits cliff in certain areas to help reduce dependency on government programs. Things that education reform bills like the Protecting Excellent Teachers Act, things that are very important to improving the quality of life for Pennsylvanians. And those things are all conservative principles. But in most cases, I was able to get, through presenting it well and building relationships, I was able to get bipartisan support for most of those bills and get them done in a way that even though Harrisburg can certainly, just like Washington, D.C., be a very contentious environment, get those done in a cooperative manner and get them enacted for the good of people in Pennsylvania.
Harrisburg does have a partisan streak.
A little streak, right?
Probably more so than in years past. But Washington, probably not a whole lot of comparison to Washington. You just said that there's, very contentious in Washington. Why did you decide to run for Congress?
I'm glad you asked it that way, Scott. Why did I decide to run? Because sometimes people say, why do you want to run? And honestly, I don't.
I could have asked it that way,
I don't want to run for Congress. I when I found out originally that my current Congressman Lou Barletta was not running for re-election, my wife and I talked a lot about whether I should run for U.S. Congress. And initially, we concluded, boy, we just don't want to get into that ugly, nasty mess down in Washington, D.C. We'll have to commute down there. It's frustrating. It's annoying. It's terrible. It's a corrupt environment. Why would you want to go there? And our initial decision that I was not going to run for Congress. But then I had a conversation with a good friend and a very blunt friend. And he asked me about, are you going to run for Congress? And I gave him my litany of reasons why I wasn't going to. And he pointed out to me very directly that, Steve, those reasons you just gave for not running, they're all very selfish reasons. Because why you don't want to go to Washington, D.C. He said, you need to think about it in terms of, do you have a duty as a conservative to defend our values and go to Washington, D.C. as an obligation, as a duty? And my wife and I then started a whole new series of conversations and prayers and ultimately decided that, yes, I do have a duty to toss my hat in the ring and do the best I can to try to win this race and serve those conservative values down in Washington, D.C. that I think really represent the nature of the folks around the 13th District.
Let's talk about some of those issues, and I will give you credit about your website, because your website, not all candidates have websites where they talk a whole lot about issues. Yes, they all have places where issues are mentioned, but yours are right up front, and you don't hide behind anything. It's right up front. So I just want to read.
And that's
right.
Bloom for Congress, by the way.
BloomForCongress.com. All right, now I shouldn't have gone that far, but let me just say here that on your website, you list repealing Obamacare, securing America's borders, strengthening military readiness, end unfair trade agreements, end taxpayer funding for abortion, defend Second Amendment freedoms. Before we take those issues one by one, what issue is a priority for you, most significant?
I mean, and all those issues are significant. For me, one of the real driving factors behind many of the issues is the just utter total irresponsibility, and in particular fiscal irresponsibility, of the United States Congress and really our government in Washington. And it's been this way, and it's getting worse over the last couple of decades. We've seen time and time again where irresponsible decisions are made. Our country gets deeper and deeper into debt. We become, as we get more financially unstable, more fiscally unstable, we become weaker as a force at home and around the world. We can't have a strong military if we're not a fiscally sound nation. We can't have good healthcare if we're not a fiscally sound nation. We can't have all the things that folks expect as part of sort of the American contract, the opportunity to succeed and go and make a difference in the world in a way that fits your talents and your needs and desires and abilities. Without a fiscally sound nation, we can't have all those things that we all expect and dream of as Americans. So that's really the top priority for me, is to try to bring the fiscal house in order. I was proud to vote for a budget my first year as a state representative that cut $1 billion in spending from Pennsylvania state government. That had not happened in anyone's memory. Going back at least 50 years, there had not been a general fund budget in Pennsylvania that actually cut spending, let alone cut it by $1 billion. Subsequent budgets that I voted for in Pennsylvania were ones that were within the rate of inflation plus population growth. Those are the kind of fiscally responsible decisions I think we need to make. And I've stood up against Governor Wolf when he's tried to overspend and then to compensate for that, raise new taxes. Those are the things that drive us deeper into economic problems, and then they exacerbate all the other problems we're facing.
All right, well, let's talk about that. From those issues you just listed, they're very consistent with the agenda of the Trump administration. In fact, on your website, you have said that the voters had a mandate when they elected Donald Trump in 2016, or they provided a mandate. The president signed an omnibus spending plan a few months ago that many Republicans were critical of it. Your thoughts on it?
I also am critical of that $1.3 trillion spending plan that was enacted by Congress and signed by the president. I'm the only candidate in this race who's endorsed by the House Freedom Caucus. And it's actually the House Freedom Fund, which is the political action arm of the House Freedom Caucus. And as I'm sure you know, the House Freedom Caucus really stood up against that bad budget deal. And I think even President Trump expressed publicly some doubts about, maybe some regrets about having signed it. But that's the kind of irresponsible spending we cannot just allow to go on and keep happening over and over again, because each time we do that, it adds another $1 trillion to the deficit. We get deeper into the national debt. It makes it harder and harder for our kids, our grandkids, and beyond to ever get out of this hole that we're getting into. So those are the kind of stands we'll have to make. And I will, as a U.S. congressman, I will join the Freedom Caucus if I'm elected, and I'll stand with like-minded conservatives against irresponsible spending.
Well, one of the alternatives, of course, increasing the debt ceiling was a big part of that. But the alternative, you would think to be able to come up with other alternatives, but the alternative was to shut down the government. Would you have voted to shut down the government?
If that's what it took to bring responsibility to the spending in Washington, absolutely. I've stood against government.
You would not vote to raise the debt ceiling. You would you would go toward...
My intention would be to not get us deeper in the hole that we're climbing into already. And as a state representative of Pennsylvania, I've been in the forefront of the battles with Governor Wolf, where we've had to have these months-long standoffs over the budget to prevent him from enacting the huge tax increases he wanted and the big spending increases. They were unpleasant. Nobody liked it. I was, as everyone else, very frustrated with the fact that we had these delayed budgets. But at the end of the day, by standing up to Governor Wolf, we won those battles. He didn't get the tax hikes he wanted. He didn't get the big spending hikes he wanted. And I think that's healthy for Pennsylvania. And that's what's allowed us to survive these last 3 years under a governor who wanted to increase spending and increase taxes more than every other governor across the entire country combined here in Pennsylvania. We stood up to that and we stopped it. that's the same kind of attitude I'll take to D.C.
But the government continued to operate even without a budget that was signed in place.
It continued in part.
It wasn't fully, but still. in the federal government.
And the same thing happens in the federal government. It doesn't come to a grinding halt. Certain things stop, but most of it goes on.
Yeah, but there are some people who don't get checks that are supposed to get
and we
them.
We need to make tough choices in those situations, and I don't think we want to take the country deeper into the debt hole.
Let me go down through the list that you have here. Repeal Obamacare. Why and replace with what?
The key for me, and this has always been one of the driving forces of why I even first ran for office in 2010, my concern about Obamacare and what it would do to our healthcare industry and the quality of healthcare and the accessibility of healthcare for American citizens. We have had a healthcare system over the decades that has innovated and improved tremendously. Diseases that were a death sentence, Scott, when you and I were kids are virtually wiped off the face of the earth. Conditions that were untreatable are treatable now. Folks generally live longer, healthier lives. And we take it for granted that, of course, the healthcare system will always get better and better. Well, it does that under free market influence conditions where doctors, where drug companies, where medical equipment companies are competing in the free marketplace, and ultimately there's a profit motive, but that's what drives the innovation. I compared it to what it used to be like when the government controlled the telecommunications sector. We all had these big boxy phones that were wired to the wall, and they were all pretty much the same, and they were minimally functional, but they didn't do a whole lot. When the government finally stepped out of the telecommunications industry, within a few short years, we started to see the mobile phones, and now we have iPhones, and it's accelerated the innovation because it's in a private sector mode. That's the same thing we need to continue to do with our healthcare, is allow the private sector influences in there to drive the innovation that actually gives more healthcare to more people. So my goal is to the extent humanly possible, remove the government from the healthcare sector and let it be, as it always was intended to be, just another sector in our economy. Certainly we need a safety net for those that, just like we do with any other type of programs, when there are going to be a few people that fall through the cracks, we need to be compassionate. We need to make sure that they're taken care of. But we don't need to nationalize or get the government intertwined with the whole entire industry to help some people who we can help more efficiently in other ways.
How can you do that? I mean, when you say a few people, actually you're talking about millions of people. And using your analogy, even poor people had those big boxy telephones where we had millions of people who didn't have insurance and didn't have access to health insurance.
But I mean, now, you know, under Obamacare, we often have people now have a card that says they have access to care, but what's the quality of that care? How accessible is it really? Where do they have to go to get it? I think a lot of the changes in Obamacare, I mean, the vast majority of people who gained access to care through Obamacare was simply because the government raised the eligibility standards for Medicaid. So you basically put a whole lot more people on Medicaid.
Would you continue to support that? Would you support that? I shouldn't say continue.
I mean, I voted against expanding Medicaid in Pennsylvania, and I would do that again in a heartbeat, because Medicaid, there's many studies that show the quality of care on Medicaid is so poor that many people have worse outcomes than when they have no insurance whatsoever. So Medicaid is not the answer. The answer is to bring free market innovation, make the whole system more accessible to more people, the greatest good for the greatest number of people.
How's that possible to have worse care if you have no insurance?
Because so many times they don't actually have access. They have a card, but they can't get to the clinics or they can't get to the doctors. Not everyone is participating in Medicaid. I can point you to the studies. There are documented studies that show worse healthcare outcomes for folks on Medicaid than the uninsured.
Probably a lot of people would like to see those studies. And, you know, Representative, we have so much to talk about that I only can spend a few minutes on each issue. If you're just tuning in, listening to Smart Talk today, our guest during this portion of the program is Stephen Bloom, a Republican running for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 13th Congressional District. The 13th District includes Adams, Franklin, and Western Cumberland County in the WITF listening area. I want to move on to some of the other issues that you mentioned, securing the border. How and do you support President Trump's plan for a wall between Mexico and the United States?
We absolutely need a secure border. Whether it certainly parts of it should be a wall, if the wall is not the most efficient solution for other sections of the border, whatever the most effective, efficient way to make sure it's actually a closed border are okay with me. But we need to work on that border security first and foremost.
Mm-hmm. What about DACA right now? I mean, it's, all of a sudden this issue has kind of fallen to the back burner.
My view has been all along that I'm all for legal immigration, just like most people. My ancestors came to this country through the legal immigration process, and that's great. Legal immigration is a wonderful thing for America, but I'm not in favor of giving special treatment to those who break the law and putting them ahead in line of the people who are following the law. So we need a secure border first. If we get that done, then we can have discussions about what to do about the other issues. But for me, it's premature to even discuss any other issues until we actually achieve security at the border.
But we do have to discuss because deadlines have been set. The president himself set some deadlines. Now courts are involved. But that these were children when they came to the United States. Would you send them back or what?
Again, that discussion, if we can get the border secured, then we can talk about DACA and all those other issues. But to me, it's premature to have that discussion until we focus on getting the border secured.
You also talk about ending taxpayer-funded abortions. Now, the law already says that the federal money can't go to pay for abortions. So what do you mean by that?
Well, there's a significant amount of federal dollars that still flow, even in that budget you just mentioned, that $1.3 trillion budget that was passed recently. There was money designated for Planned Parenthood, which is an organization that clearly performs a tremendous amount of its efforts are focused on providing abortions. And so that agency benefits from those dollars. And to me, that's encouraging abortion. And I'm personally and politically opposed to abortion because I believe that that child from the moment of conception is a human life and we shouldn't be ending those lives. And certainly the government shouldn't be helping in the process of killing babies in the womb.
Planned Parenthood argues with that. They say that, the law says we can't use federal money for abortions. So no, what the money is going for is contraception, for sex education.
I mean, it's a big organization. It's a multi-million dollar organization. And clearly, if the federal government is subsidizing some areas of their operation, they can shift resources to the others. And I believe certainly, it's not disputed that Planned Parenthood is one of the largest, if not the largest, provider of abortions in this country.
So you would vote to defund Planned Parenthood?
Absolutely, would vote to defund Planned Parenthood.
Defend Second Amendment freedoms in what form?
Well, we have in this country, obviously, a constitution that spells out that we have the right to keep and bear arms, and the courts have reaffirmed that over and over again, including the U.S. Supreme Court. And we know that we have that right. It's a core function of who we are. We have all sorts of laws on the books already attempting to restrict access to guns and weapons. And we've seen time and time again that those laws really don't help. You have laws against having guns in schools, yet people bring guns into schools and break those laws and hurt people. We have gun-free zones where citizens are held defenseless for these mass killers to step in to an area where they know there's nobody there that can stop them. We have laws against murder, and yet people still commit murder. The laws aren't what are going to help us. We need to enforce laws. We have, but we need to address the underlying issues. We have a troubled society. We have folks who don't have a reverence for human life. And while government has a role in solving that problem, that's not entirely a problem that government can address. How do you resolve the spiritual condition of someone who feels like it's okay to go and kill a bunch of other individuals who are, they don't even know them? I mean, there's something wrong. There are societal issues at play. But trying to address those by taking away the rights of law-abiding citizens to protect themselves, it doesn't make sense. And so I'm not in favor of additional gun control legislation.
Do you believe that there is a legitimate effort in this country to take away guns?
Oh,
There
absolutely is. I mean, just in the last several months, we've seen folks come out on the anti-gun left and say things like, it's time to repeal the Second Amendment. I mean, there really are people who do believe that we should that the gun rights of Americans should be taken away, and I will always defend our gun rights because without that Second Amendment freedom, that puts the rest of our Bill of Rights in jeopardy.
But with hundreds of millions of guns in our society right now, is it realistic to believe that? I mean, I remember when President Obama was elected. Oh, he's going to come get your guns. When Hillary Clinton was running in 2016, she's going to come get your guns. if anything, we have more guns now. I mean, so is that a realistic belief that that Americans could lose the right to bear arms?
I mean, societies over you know, if you look at world societies and the history of countries around the world, that, you know, gun control has been pushed on countries that at one time allowed citizens to carry weapons, and other and tyrannical governments have taken away those rights, and terrible consequences have ensued. So it's a real fear in human history that citizens could be deprived of the ability to protect themselves.
Real quick, I want to follow up on that and then ask you, you know, why you feel you're the best candidate, because I only have about a minute or so left. Got an A-plus rating from the NRA. Are there any issues in which you disagree with the National Rifle Association?
But the only issue that I've disagreed with the NRA on in terms of their political agenda is in Pennsylvania. We have a Sunday hunting ban in Pennsylvania. It's an old blue law, I guess you would call it, from going back in the day. In Pennsylvania, you're not allowed to hunt on Sundays. The NRA has consistently pushed for allowing Sunday hunting in Pennsylvania. And I didn't have any real philosophical objection to that, but I talked to many of the farmers and landowners in the district I currently represent and found out that they were opposed to Sunday hunting because they want a day of rest on their farms and properties, and they would close their properties to hunting if there was Sunday hunting.
And that's an issue we're going to discuss on Smart Talk here. Stephen Bloom, I wish we had more time. So many other issues. Republican running for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 13th District. Thank you very much for being with
us
today.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate it.
Coming up on Monday, we're going to continue our conversations with the candidates. That's coming up most of next week as we approach the May 15th primary in Pennsylvania.